Well, I tend to think of the Gosling as a poem. The critical opening phrase of this poem will always be the grip, which the hands unite to form a single unit. Slowly and slowly, the club head is led back, pulled into position not by the hands, but by the body, which turns away from the target, shifting weight to the right side without shifting balance. Tempo is everything, perfection unattainable. As the body coils now to the top of the swing, there's a slight hesitation, a little nod to the gods. Now the weight begins shifting back to the left, pulled by the powers inside the earth. It's alive, this swing, a living sculpture, and down through contact, always down, striking the ball crisply, with character. There was only one other acceptable theory about how to hit a golf ball.
Oh, boy. Oh, what's the other theory?
Grip it and rip it.
This is the Sports Hub Golf Club on 98.5 The Sports Hub. Now, here's your host, Hardy.
Good morning. Welcome to the Sports Hub Golf Club on what is, I believe, the second official day of summer. Does that sound right? Seems like summer. It seems like the longest days of the year, as it was bright enough outside my bedroom windows to read the newspaper at 5 o'clock this morning. Not that I did, but the point is this: more time than ever to get out and play if you have a chance to get out there. So hopefully that is on your agenda for the weekend. Also happening this weekend, a couple of golf tournaments going on. There is, we're going to be doing a lot of U.S. Open wrap-up today, first and foremost. And Gary Woodland got the win at Pebble Beach last weekend, so we'll be talking quite a bit about that. A few other tournaments going on. There's one that, I will fully admit, you know, and I'm not going to be glib about this. I'm not going to say anything even remotely like Hank Haney did about the women's tournament or the women's tour. Quite frankly, because I don't share a lot of his feelings. And second of all, I feel really dumb. I did not know until yesterday or the day before that there was a significant tournament happening right now as far as the LPGA is concerned, and that is the KPMG Women's PGA Championship, one of their majors taking place right now at Hazeltine National in Minnesota. And I watched a good part of that last night, and I got to tell you, given the choice between watching that and watching, the week before and the week after a major championship is tough for people hosting golf tournaments. It just is. I remember years ago, the organizers of the John Deere Classic, the tournament right before the British Open, started chartering a huge jet to take players directly from the course where the John Deere Classic was hosted across the Atlantic to wherever the British Open was being played in an effort to get guys just to show up and play. It's not easy. So many players want to take that week off before a major or after a major because, I mean, it sounds silly, I guess, but it takes a lot out of you. The week before I get, you know, there's preparation involved. You want to get to the venue as early as you can. You want to get in as many practice rounds as you can and get yourself situated because, you know, it's a major championship. It's what these guys want probably more than anything else. The week after is where it might sound silly, but I get it. It takes a lot out of you, you know, and it's across all sports. You know, and I'm not comparing, golfers to what virtually any other players do, athletes do in any other sports, and I hesitate to call them athletes. I think there are a lot of golfers who are athletes, but just because one plays professional golf does not make one an athlete. I get that. But we heard Charlie McAvoy talking about it during the Cup Final. It's not just the physical, you know, stress of the game. Yeah, they're playing every other night for the first two games and the second two games, but after that, you know, you've got days off in between. He just talked about how exhausting it was with all the attention being paid to it and everybody wanting to talk to every player seemingly before games, in the days in between, after games. You know, it's just taxing for these guys. So my point is this: to get players to go to the whatever it is, the Travelers Championship or whatever, it's not easy. And I think the leaderboard is indicative of that. Zach Sucher? I don't know. Now, Ches Reavie, I know, first of all, Zach Sucher is 11 under par. He's the leader. After that, it's Ches Reavy, who's two strokes off the lead. Keegan Bradley, that's nice. Ryan Moore. Bronson Bergen. I literally don't know who a couple of these guys are who are on the first page of the leaderboard. Jason Day, we're going to talk more about him in a minute. And Robert Streb, Colin Morikawa. That's what's going on the men's tour right now. So if I'm going to be watching golf this weekend, it's most likely going to be what I started watching yesterday, and that's the Women's PGA Championship. And I was reminded once again of why I enjoy watching women's golf so much, because, oh my God, at players of all levels, if you want to emulate how other players at the highest level play their game, it would be wonderful to aspire to the lengths that Dustin Johnson and Brooks Koepka and Gary Woodland, we'll talk about him in a moment, you know, get with their drivers. It would be amazing to be able to dig the ball out of the rough and send the ball out of ankle-deep rough 200 yards on target toward the green like Rory McIlroy. The fact is, 99% of us will never do it. What we can do is swing with rhythm and balance and hit the ball with accuracy and find the center of the club face and dial in the short game and play like the women do. Now, I'm not saying we could do that either, but at least that is a more reasonable expectation. And I think in some ways a more attainable aspiration. I have no illusions of being able to play the game like these women do, ever. But at least I feel like I take more away from watching them in terms of how I should be playing my game than I do of watching some of the men play who just they play with a reckless abandon. They play with a strength that I don't have. They play with a club head speed that I don't have, and most of the women do too. But I think there are more comparables to what you see some of the women doing that we could at least strive for. You know what I'm saying? And by the way, just the quality of golf and the quality of the players out there. Hannah Green is the leader right now. She's 7 under par so far at the Women's PGA. She's 3 strokes clear of anyone else. And some, you know, if you follow women's golf at all, there are some big names near the top of the leaderboard. Lydia Ko is 4 strokes off the lead right now. Lexi Thompson is under par, one of the dozen or so players that are under par so far. She's at 1 under. So there are some recognizable names and faces out there to watch, but more than anything, I have so much respect and admiration for what they do, and this goes back to when I would take my daughter out to watch the Symetra Tour players when they played a couple of tournaments at Thorny Lee. And there's just something about the intelligence and the skill that it takes to play their game the way they do, you know, and it's not like watching the men, you know, on a 400 yard par 4. A lot of the guys you watch will not even bother to, if it's a straightaway par 4 sitting around 400 yards, a lot of the men won't even take out a driver. You know, they'll choose a driving iron or maybe a 5-wood. You know, they'll put something out there still 250 and leave themselves, an 8-iron in. And that's how they would rather play that type of hole. The women, I play the hole. And again, nothing like I do because they're so much better. But they will hit the same clubs and sometimes hit them, you know, on my best day in a way that I can relate to. So when my daughter and I would go out there and watch them play a par 4 like that, they'll take out a driver on a 400-yard par 4, and they'll crack at 250 down the middle. And then for their next shot, they will take out a 7-iron or a 6-iron. And, excuse me, not necessarily hit the towering high ball that lands right next to the pin, but they'll play something a little just smarter and in a way that I can one day hope to more readily duplicate. Play something up to the front of the green that trickles on and rolls up to that same position right next to the pin and then walk up there and drain their birdie putt. You know, that's something I can at least relate to, even if I can't do it. So anyway, don't forget about that. Don't forget about a women's major that's going on this weekend. Back to the U.S. Open. Gary Woodland is your U.S. Open champion. As I'm sure you know, you got a chance to watch primetime golf, as I did, at the end of last week and last weekend, which I thought was fantastic. I think I think the U.S. Open, at least one major tournament every year, and it's not going to be the Masters, and it's not going to be the British, so either the PGA or the U.S. Open, and preferably both, should be contested out on the West Coast so we can watch primetime golf. I mean it. I mean, just have it out there, because it was cool to be able to just sit back and watch golf right up until 9, 10 o'clock at night. It was great. Gary Woodland, as you know, ended up 13 under par, four rounds in the 60s. Brooks Koepka, sole possession of second place, and notable for two reasons. Because he was the only one in second, it was not a tie for second, and he was three strokes clear of the third place finisher, Xander Schauffele. He was also three strokes behind Woodland, but something else of note, Brooks Koepka became the first player in U.S. Open history to have four rounds in the 60s and not win. So Brooks Koepka, who was going for an unprecedented third U.S. Open in a row, fell short, three strokes short. Gary Woodland, far and away your champion, I get it. But huge credit to Brooks Koepka for hanging in there, alone in second place, and a second place finish for the ages. So well done by Brooks Koepka. I think the story ended up being a couple of things. Number one, the course itself. There were a lot of players under par. I mean, you look down the leaderboard here, and this was not a typical U.S. Open where you had a few guys ran around 4-under, 5-under, maybe a few behind them, and the rest over par. Now, you had a ton of guys, 31 of them, as a matter of fact, to break par at Pebble Beach over the course of four rounds in a setup that is supposed to be the hardest that these guys are going to face all year. Now, I don't know that the USGA ever says that out loud, but it's just become understood that the U.S. Open is going to be the toughest test that these guys face all year. The problem is, it got away from them last year. And it literally got away from them to the point where at Shinnecock last year, players said they let the golf course get away from them. It was too dry. It was too fast. The greens wouldn't hold. The scores were ballooning. It was not something that a lot of players felt was a quote-unquote fair setup. I'm not one of these guys that cries for these guys and says, oh, too bad. That's too bad. They've really been unfair to you guys. No, I'm okay with seeing them struggle for one tournament out of the year on conditions that are less than perfect. But I also understand what is fair and what is unfair, and they just let the course get away from them. Now at Pebble, you can, and we will talk a little bit about what actually happened there in terms of why it played perhaps a little too easy. But the real fallout is going to happen next year. When they go back to Wingfoot next year, look out, because the USGA, again, you know, the U.S. Open is not put on by the PGA of America. This is the USGA, and they are not going to allow 31 players to finish under par next year at Wingfoot. That for as many guys who enjoyed the greens that held at Pebble Beach last week, and the rough that wasn't quite as rough as they thought it was going to be, the pin placements that were tough, but they weren't unfair, they weren't too tough. Everybody who makes it into the field at Wingfoot next year is going to pay the price for that, because that setup is going to be treacherous. It is going to be something the likes of which they haven't seen at least since last year when the course got away from them. And I don't think they're going to let the course get away from them in terms of conditions and drying out, you know, as much as they can do with Mother Nature involved. but they will make the setup itself in terms of the fairway width and the length of the rough and the speed of the greens, something that is not going to lend itself to 31 players finishing the tournament under par and having a couple of guys finish double digits under par. That won't be happening. All right, more on Gary Woodland, the winner. More on what other people around golf expect from him going, going forward. And our lesson segment of the day will be coming up. It's all about putting, courtesy of Stephen Daly. He's the head professional at the Cape Club of Sharon. That'll be coming up here in just a few more minutes as we continue on the Sports Hub Golf Club this morning.
This is the Sports Hub Golf Club.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top five Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
Getting you ready to hit the links. It's the Sports Hub Golf Club with Hardy on 98.5, the Sports Hub.
Welcome back to the Sports Hub Golf Club. So, talking a little bit about Gary Woodland, who is our U.S. Open winner. Brooks Koepka vying for a third straight U.S. Open. Fell short, but not by much. Finished in sole possession of second place. A group of ESPN writers got together, a round table, if you will. Bob Herrig, who's been on this show before, Michael Collins, Ian O'Connor, Mark Schlabach, to kind of like, you know, do a post-mortem on it. And they were all asked if Brooks Koepka will somehow be affected negatively by missing out on his third U.S. Open. Look, it's a question that has to be asked. I don't think anybody thinks that. Herrig, Collins, O'Connor, and Schlabach among them. So, Brooks Koepka has had an amazing run here at back-to-back U.S. Opens and a PGA Championship. And don't you worry about Brooks Koepka. He'll be fine. Here's the more interesting question posed to all these guys about Gary Woodland. Now, Gary Woodland's only won a handful of times in his career, and he's a journeyman. He's been out on tour for 10-plus years, and now that – you know, he's won a major championship to go with his, you know, three regular tournament wins. Will he win another major? All right. It's not enough to win a major championship. It's will you win another? And once you get past the, oh, geez, can we just let him enjoy it? Well, no, we're not sitting at his dinner table. You know, we're talking amongst ourselves here, so we can talk about it. Everyone says that, of course, he's got the game. You know, he's always had a great long game, but he's certainly got his putter working, and he seems to have figured things out around the greens. And, well, sure, he can win one. He's got some confidence now. So, these writers pretty much said, yes. O'Connor was the only one. He said, I'll give him one more. Michael Collins, who is very happy-go-lucky, he is Mr. Positive out there. He said, I think Woodland can win another one, but if he doesn't, we shouldn't be shocked because they are hard to win. And then Bob Herrig is the one standalone guy who said, I'll guess he won't win another major. I thought, what? Bob Herrig? But we've talked to him on the show. Bob Herrig seems like a nice guy. He doesn't seem like a negative guy. Here's what Bob Herrig said. Many times we've wondered if a major victory would lead to more for a player. Look at all the players with just one. All right. Who? Jason Day, Adam Scott, Dustin Johnson. Oh, crap, you're right. All those guys only have one major. Woodland's overall record is short on victories, so maybe this spurs him to more, but I will guess he won't win another major. That's from Bob Herrig of ESPN. I thought it was telling. I thought it was an interesting comment and a truly open-minded one, and one that also probably, if not overtly, but at least subconsciously, speaks to what happens to guys who win the U.S. Open and how many more championships they go on to win. There are a ton of golfers with one major championship under their belt, one and only one, and that one happens to be the U.S. Open. Let me get, and I'm not going to go back, and part of this is because for many, many years, there were only the U.S. Open and the British Opens, and then the amateurs. Those were considered the four major championships. That was it. You know, the Masters came along much later, as did the PGA Championship. So in terms of sheer numbers of people who only have one major, and that one major happens to be a U.S. Open, well, the numbers are skewed because for many years there was only the U.S. Open and the British Open, and that's not a fair assessment of what it means to win that one U.S. Open. But if you go, say, starting in the 1950s and look at the players who have won one major championship, and that one major is a U.S. Open, it's a pretty telling list. I mean, see if any of these guys, just by, you know, what conjures up when I say their name reminds you of a player like Gary Woodland. Again, nice player, good player, been on tour for a long time, been around for a long time, few wins here and there, but only broke through once. Does that sound like your 1958 winner, Tommy Bolt, or Ken Venturi? One major championship for Ken Venturi at the U.S. Open in 1964. Same goes for Orville Moody, Lou Gramm, not the singer from Foreigner, Lou Gramm. That's a different Lou Gramm. Jerry Pate, Scott Simpson, Tom Kite, Corey Pavin, Steve Jones. Who? Oh, yeah, Steve Jones, U.S. Open winner from 1996. Jim Furyk, Michael Campbell. These are the recent guys. Now we're into the 2000s. Jeff Ogilvie, Lucas Glover, Graham McDowell, Webb Simpson, Justin Rose, Dustin Johnson, and so far, as of today, without having had any other chances after his first win, Gary Woodland. That is some kind of list, boy. Think about all those guys and the expectations. Tom Kite was a leading money winner on tour for years. He won one major championship, and it was a U.S. Open. Corey Pavin, everybody loves Corey Pavin, one major, and it was the U.S. Open. Dustin Johnson's going to take over golf with his length off the tee and his ability. One major, it was the U.S. Open in 2016. And you can say what you will about a bunch of these other guys. I mean, we all assume Justin Rose is going to win more. We're all shocked that Jim Furyk hasn't won more. But all these guys won one major championship, and it was a U.S. Open. And Gary Woodland could very easily find himself listed among those players forever. Because going back to what Michael Collins said, first and foremost, they're hard to win. And unless you are the type of player who is going to go out there and just, you know, it's almost a foregone conclusion, is going to win 3, 4, 5, 6 major championships over the course of your career. Hell, it's one more U.S. Open than most people will ever win, obviously. But there is something about that tournament that lends itself to one-and-done types of guys. I want to bring up one more tournament going on this weekend. Let's just say it again. Congratulations to Gary Woodland and a U.S. Open at Pebble Beach, which was always fun to watch. Love watching at Pebble. But moving on now, Champions Tour event also going on this weekend. Jerry Kelly, 7-under 65 on Friday. He's got a first round lead at the American Family Insurance Championship. You may not care so much about that. What you might care about is John Smoltz. I know Billy Lanny, our producer, his ears just perked up. John Smoltz opened up with a 76 in his third start on the Champions Tour. Now, I have, it might irk some people that he is identified merely as the former Atlanta Braves star, forgetting about other places he's played, but that's fine. That's how he's most well known. John Smoltz is one of the rare exceptions to the players who say once they get done with whatever career they're in, whether it's baseball, whether it's hockey, I've heard hockey players talk about this before. Football players, Tony Romo, all these guys who say, you know what? Of course, I made my living playing football or hockey or whatever, but I'd really like to give golf a shot, and that is my goal, to make it onto the tour, maybe onto the Champions Tour. And I say, across the board, you're not going to do it. You're not going to do it. What are you talking about? These guys have dedicated their lives to that game, starting at an early age, most of them. At the very least, in their late teens, they didn't go play another sport for 10 or 12 years and then get serious about golf. They've been serious about golf for their entire adult lives. What are you talking about? John Smoltz is at least doing it to the degree that he is played now in his third tour start on the Champions Tour. He's still in there on a sponsor exemption. So I'm not saying he's arrived yet, but Smoltz is a phenomenal player, as is Tony Romo. As is Steph Curry. All these guys are really, really good. You're not good enough to go out there and play against the likes of Steve Stricker and Corey Pavin and, hell, John Daly. We've seen John Daly, who can't even walk a golf course anymore. He shot a 68. I mean, these guys who aren't even all that good anymore are still five strokes better than John Smoltz, who is a phenomenal golfer, has been for a long time. I go back to what Ray Bourque told me a couple of years ago. I asked him about this at a media day for the U.S. Senior Open when it was being held at the Salem Country Club. And I said, Ray, you've been a really good golfer for a long time, you know, while you were playing and you know, since you hung up your skates. And we talked about a lot of stuff, but I said, what would you tell, you know, guys, either fellow hockey players or baseball players or football players who are really good at golf, like you are, Ray, single-digit handicap. You know, guys who are really good at golf, that they're really going to focus in on their game and that they're going to go out and get on tour or even get on the Champions Tour once they, you know, hit the age over 50. And he just said, don't, because you're not going to. So much for the can-do spirit. But he's right. That's what I've been saying all along. It's not going to happen. Good for John Smoltz out there playing on a sponsor exemption and, you know, playing for a third time now out there on the Champions Tour. So much better at this game than I'll ever be. But you're competing against guys who have been doing this their entire lives. They haven't been taking time off to go be at the top of their field in another discipline like baseball, John. It's not your fault. Look at me, Sean, it's not your fault. Oh, sorry, Will. Will, it's not your fault. It's okay. It goes back to the Tom Brady thing. Isn't it okay to be the best quarterback who ever played the game without having to also be, the founder of TB12 and, you know, curing the world of their inability to stretch, you know? Tom Brady, another great golfer. I think even Tom Brady would be the first to admit, hell no, I'm not going to go be on the Champions Tour when I get done with football in another 10 years. What are you talking about? That's insanity. But good for John Smoltz if you want to check him out this weekend during the Champions Tour event. All right, step aside here. We'll get the headlines from Sean Silver. Then we'll get our lesson from the day from Stephen Daly, head professional, Cape Club of Sharon, all about putting. That's coming up next here on the Sports Hub Golf Club.
Stay tuned for more of the Sports Hub Golf Club.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
You're listening to the Sports Hub Golf Club on 98.5 The Sports Hub. Now, here's Hardy.
Time to try and get better at this game with Stephen Daly. He's the head professional here at the Cape Club of Sharon. Stephen, today I want to talk about putting. Again, it's a huge subject, but we can all do more, I'm sure,
to be better in this critical part of the game. So you give lessons here at the Cape Club all the time. I don't know how many of them involve putting, but in your assessment, how much time should we be working on our putting when we're working on our golf games?
All of it. You got to practice your putting. It's the most important thing. And, you know, the game within the game in putting is the speed. You know, the speed is the most important thing. Your ball can be a little offline, you know, from distances and such, but the speed of the putt is going to really be the key for you.
You know what? And it sounds like hyperbole, but honestly, if you were to just eliminate all other practice and not worry about your iron play or hitting your drives, because for me, even when I'm feeling good, I have no idea what my swing is going to be like that day. Putting is the one thing that seems to be more consistent than anything else. And if you can get consistently better at putting through practice, that's the one thing that is consistently going to reward you week after week, round after round.
Yeah, definitely. You know, the one more 6-footer we make or the one less 3-putt that we have, you know, you're going to affect your score a lot more than, you know, some other shots from different parts of the course.
You say 3-putt. Did I ever tell you about the time I 4-jacked it out here on the 9th green at the Cape Club? Do you have a minute? I'm not even going to tell you. Second time in my life that I can remember actually 4-putting a green. Well, you guys put the pin all the way back that day, and I did. Granted, I didn't, you know, hit my approach as far as I should have, but up on that shelf, next thing I know, I've got a 10-foot comeback. We don't have enough time. All right, so let's move on to more positive thoughts. Speed. It's really all about the speed, especially for putts, I would say, outside of like 4 or 5 feet, where you may not have a perfect read of that green, but what you can be almost perfect with is the speed.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, what the one thing that people really don't think about is the speed of the putt is being decided in your green reading. You know, when you're reading a putt and you're looking at how it's going to break, in your mind, subconsciously, you're thinking about the speed that it's going to be at when it takes that break. So one way I like to do it is kind of start from the hole and come backwards and look at as to where you think the ball should fall in the hole and then develop a line based on the speed that will put the ball into the hole at that particular point.
Somebody asked Tiger recently about his putting routine. And it may have been Jason Sobel who said, you know, it's the greatest, you know, pre-putt routine he'd ever heard. He said, well, I get an idea for, you know, the break, and I get a feel for the speed, and I just see what happens. You know, that was it. And I think that's a great attitude to have toward putting. You're not going to be able to control everything about it, but as long as you have an idea of how it's going to break, you know, pick your line, get a feel for the speed, because that's where the feel comes in. You have to let it go at that point, because you have no control after it. You just have to put a good roll on the ball. And if it's on the line you want and it's, you know, the correct feel you have for that speed, you just kind of have to let yourself go.
Yeah, you know, you got to know that you're probably going to, you know, you're definitely going to miss more putts than you make. So that feel, as like Tiger would refer to, a little drill that I would normally do is, in my practice putting stroke, I keep my eyes on the hole and let my body – my eyes are almost teaching my body how hard I should swing the putter to develop the speed for that particular putt.
I've seen players do that, and I'm reluctant to try it myself because it looks like the routine of a much better player. But that seems to be something that a lot of guys do. They'll stand over the ball and look at the hole as they're kind of just taking the putter back and forth, you know, just stroke after stroke. It's all about the speed at that point.
Yeah, exactly. Just make sure you're not too close to the ball. I saw a guy do it and clip the toe of his shoe there, and the club bounced and hit the ball on his practice swing. So maybe do it behind the ball or something. But it's a great way for your eyes just to, you know, teach your body what it's going to be like. And, you know, as Tiger referred to, those feels, that's how you're going to, you know, put the pace on the ball that you think is needed for that particular putt.
Okay, so I'm reluctant to say, you know, walk all the way around the hole and all that stuff, because pace of play is, you know, a killer for this sport. So I want to keep people moving on the green. So what's another good way, as opposed to, you know, walking all around the ball and from every angle? What's another good way of judging the speed of a putt that can be done quickly?
Well, what I like to do, certainly on the practice green before I even go out, is roll a ball not to a hole but just to the edge of the green. So I go from maybe 10 feet away from the edge of the green, then 15 feet, then 20 feet, and just practice rolling balls right up to the edge of the green. Some will go onto the fringe, some will stay short, but just learning the speed of that green. And then really once you get on the course, it's just determining whether it's uphill or downhill. The break shouldn't normally be too hard left or right, and you know, just try to refer back to that practice session, and that should give you a good feel on the speed.
Waste your time on the practice green, not on the golf course. Let's keep things moving out there, you know. And finally, Stephen, I want to ask you about this. When it comes to putting, the center of the club face gets talked about a lot in terms of driving. You and I have talked about it with iron play and chipping and pitching, but finding the center of the club face with a putter is also really important.
Yeah, you know, you can see some of the best players in the world before they go out and play. They're all using these different, you know, Tiger just uses two tees on either side of the putter. Just to, all that is making a little gate, and it's all it's doing is confirming that he's hitting the center of the putter every single time. It's not doing anything else.
It's not for the path of his putter as much as it is, no, center of the putter is as important as the center of a 7-iron.
Right. Yeah, you don't, if you hit a toe of a 7-iron, it's not going to go its normal 150. It's similar as a putt. You know, if you have a 30-footer and you don't hit it on the center, it's not going to go the distance.
And if there's one thing I want to take away from this, Stephen, it's the first thing that you said, how much should we be spending out of our practice time in putting? Stephen says, all of it. Just, you know, honestly, forget about the other stuff for a while. Do nothing but putting. Is there another way to dramatically increase your scores from week to week other than practicing nothing but putting?
I think that's the best way.
That's it. Stephen Daly, head professional, Cape Club of Sharon. Always good to see you, Stephen. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Stay tuned for more of the Sports Hub Golf Club.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top five Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
This is the Sports Hub Golf Club. Now, here's your host, Hardy.
Back to wrap things up here on the Sports Hub Golf Club. One more story I wanted to get to. This is coming to us from Europe, the European Tour. A French golfer, Clément Berardo. I don't know what I was just trying to do with his last name. Forget I did it. Let me just totally Americanize it. Clément Berardo. Okay, there we go. Berardo DQ'd from a challenge tour event for, wait for it, running out of golf balls. Didn't we just talk about this last week? This was our final topic of conversation last week relating to Tiger Woods and what happened to him at the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach back in 2000, when Tiger won the tournament by 15 strokes, 12 under par, next closest player, 3 over par. Tiger Woods almost ran out of golf balls, all because he had not putted well in a previous round. I think he was out there on Saturday. Friday, he wasn't happy with his putting, so he took a few balls out of the bag and took them back to his hotel room. He was just putting on the carpet in his hotel room. And then throughout the course of the round, you know, he like nicked one ball and he gave that to a kid and he gave another ball to a kid. And then when he comes to the 18th hole, he hooks his ball into the ocean and he goes to get another ball from his caddy, Stevie Williams. And Stevie at that point realizes, I only got one ball left in the bag. Oh, crap. So he didn't want to say that to Tiger because as a caddy, you've got, you know, hey, that's a hard job. You got to do all that. Yeah, here's what you need to do. Make sure your player's got enough balls, enough tees, a backup glove, the rain suit if the weather's iffy. He's got 14 clubs in his bag, no more, no less, and keep up. Right? Keep up. Tend the pin. It's just caddy, right? And out of those handful of things, he didn't have enough balls in the bag. Now, this is where it gets interesting. Because in the story last week with Tiger, we learned through a tiny bit of research here and the things I was reading, he actually would not have been disqualified Tin Cup style, right? We all know the final scene in Tin Cup where Kevin Costner, you know, Roy McAvoy. He needs to put his final shot on the green because Romeo, you know, Cheech tells him, it's like, hey, this is the last ball in the bag, pard. You know, you sink this one and we're disqualified. Not exactly the case, at least according to U.S. Open rules. Tiger would have been able, with a two-stroke penalty, to borrow another ball from one of his playing partners or competitors, provided it was the exact same ball. Now, he was playing a new Nike prototype ball, so he probably wouldn't have been able to do that. You can run to the pro shop. I don't know if they were stocking those. Worst case scenario, he would have had to go back to the hotel room, send someone back to the hotel room, get a couple of balls, bring them back, and he would have been, again, charged the two-stroke penalty for delay. But not a disqualification. Clement Berardo was disqualified. He ran out of balls. It was in the first round of a match in Spain, and he lost his final ball on the 16th hole. He was disqualified for failing to finish his round. Aha. So I think Berardo could have gotten another ball. Why didn't he just go get another ball from the pro shop? Why didn't he borrow one from a playing competitor? What? There's probably all out there playing Callaways or Titleist or something. You know, there's somebody else got to be playing the exact same model of ball as Berardo. Well, it turns out he was well over par at that point. He started on the ninth hole, or on the first hole, excuse me, with a quadruple bogey 9 on the first hole, bogeyed the 6th and the 8th, so he made the turn 41. He shot 41 on the front. So by the time he lost the last ball in his bag on number 16, he didn't care anymore. He didn't care enough to go to the pro. He didn't care enough to turn to the guy next to him he was playing with and saying, hey, any chance you're playing a Callaway Chrome Soft X? He's like, you know what? Fine. This is my excuse. I get to end this 2 holes early. Thank you very much. Tim McCone, let me ask you something.
Yep.
Have you ever gone through every ball in your golf bag?
I was just trying to figure out how many balls I need to be confident that I'm going to be able to finish the round.
Yeah, that's a better question. When you go out to play, how many balls do you have in your golf bag so that you feel, okay, I can go out there, play 18, and I'm not going to be in trouble? How many balls do you like to have?
Realistically, if it's under 6, I'm not confident that that's going to happen. Yeah.
Yeah. I think a lot of us operate the same way. I like to have – I'll generally have a couple of balls that I finished, you know, my last round with. Whatever one I was playing with and the one in my pocket, those two are loose. I want to have at least another full sleeve in my bag and know that I've got I would say 5 is my bare minimum for playing confidently.
Yeah, I'm not so confident with just 5 either. I'm feeling I'm feeling pretty nervous. Yeah.
You need that 6th. Okay. Yeah. No, that's maybe a conversation for next week. I have seen guys go to the pro shop and buy a dozen golf balls and stick them in there.
Throw them in.
And those are the guys who are like, please don't let that guy be in front of me.
Yeah, exactly.
Please, anywhere else, God bless you. But the guy feels like he needs to spend like pro shop dollars to buy a dozen golf balls before he can, you know, comfortably set out on 18 holes. That's going to be a problem for everybody that day. All right, Mr. McCone, what do you have coming up today? You and Mike Flynn little bit later?
It's me and Flynn. I think we're going to do a lot of Celtic stuff.
Hi, Hardy. I didn't even know this was a crossover. I haven't talked to you for ages. How's your golf game?
What's up, buddy?
You hitting them straight?
Not too straight and a little too often. I was just talking about you yesterday with Ted Johnson. I said, you know, Mike Flynn is the rarest of breeds, an offensive lineman who is not a disgusting human being. He's put together. He's clean. He's hygienic. I don't know how you did it all those years, because it must have either you were just like in a different place in life or a different place in your head. I just can't imagine you in there, you know, day after day, week after week, mixing it up with those animals.
I got to tell you, it is. And I put Zolak in that category. The and it's nothing wrong with that. It's those guys for, but the typical, like, right, break the beer bottle over your head, wear the same clothes every day, all season, you know, eat with your hands, that type of thing. But yeah, I've always been away from that. I guess I'm using quotation for a lineman. I guess I put myself together. I mean, compared to the other animals. So.
Oh yeah, you're like the James Bond of.
Yes, I'm the James Bond of. I like that. I'm going to use that. The James Bond of offensive linemen.
So what do we got on tap today, boys?
I think big Celtics today. I walked in and Silver and McCone are crying in their beer about the Celtics, and they're angry. So, I mean, I think that's the hot topic here. What a bad week. What a bad week for the Celtics. And listen, Kyrie Irving, not a big fan of just the way it played out. And I understand you don't want to give Al Horford $115 million. I think that's ridiculous. But then the draft and confusion, what direction, but oof, you dump Baines for nothing after he opts in for you. I mean, it's just a bad, bad week for the Celtics. On the heels of probably one of the worst seasons in Celtics history, and it's not about wins and losses, it's just kind of how it went down. So
yeah, I'm trying to just view it objectively, almost academically. Like, I'm very interested to see what they're doing. Because right now it's like, you just drafted guys with those picks. I understand you probably couldn't do much with them. What are you gonna, like, you know, give it all away for the fourth overall pick? Okay, I understand that, but and Bane's gone too. All right, very interesting. what do you got in store, Danny? I'm fascinated. Like I said, I'm trying to take like the 30,000 foot view and just, you know, view it from afar without getting too invested. So, all right. Well, it'll be good to hear you guys break it down, and enjoy the rest of your Saturday, huh?
All right, buddy. Talk to you soon.
All right. And we will be back, of course, next week. Thank you, Billy Lanny, for producing this morning, and Sean Silver for the headlines. We'll do it again next week on the Sports Up Golf Club. But as you heard, Tim McComb, Mike Flynn coming up next.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.